You're listening to the Podcast with a K, available on iTunes, Stitcher.com, and Audio Boo. Welcome, listeners. This is what do we call this one? Podcast with a K, isn't it? Yeah.
That's the K.
So for a moment, I thought that was the wrong one and that we'd moved on from there like we had before. And that was, you know, the taboo name that we weren't allowed to say. So, it's only me and Brian today, as I called it in the email earlier. So it'll be the Podfast with a K because I'm feeling particularly unimaginative. And today we're going to be doing a commentary over a time flight. I was going to say Tomb of the Cybermen, which we were going to do, and then Brian chickened out and thought you'd all like to hear a story which wasn't quite as obvious as Tomb of the Cybermen. I've got quite an interesting foldback in my headphones at the moment, which is making me sound really quite relaxing to myself, and it's calming me down. It's a really weird, chemical reaction. So we're going to sort of go straight into Tomb of the Cybermen. We're going to count down, and then we're going to press play, and you listen along with us if you want to. We'll be talking generally about the story rather than bit by bit, or put the DVD into your cyber drive or whatever you have in the future. And because obviously I've still not got to Blu-ray yet, obviously, so the future is still DVD, and follow along with us. So here we go. We're going in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Ooh.
Oh, that's loud.
Yeah.
Turn it down.
Can you hear mine?
I can't hear anything over mine.
Okay, yeah. Boy, mine is loud, and it won't control the headset.
I always going to be funny, so just remember, of course, this is recording on my end, so everyone else will have got that blast in their ear as well. So everyone across the country will have had the pain of time flight, which of course is kind of suited because a lot of people think that time flight is indeed a pain. You, Brian, before we go into this, are sort of reactionary to that. You resist that notion, which is kind of hopefully going to be interesting for people.
Yeah, I don't know. I enjoy this story. There's a lot of things I like about it. I don't know. I mean, I've heard people don't like it, but I don't recall ever hearing why they don't like it. So I don't know what to refute offhand. So I'll just, I don't know, give my points here.
I really like part one. Part one I always enjoyed. It's like going back to Spearhead from Space, which we only just did the other week, back into a scanner room, radar booth, air traffic control, whatever you'd call them. This one obviously centres a hell of a lot around Heathrow Airport. It's Heathrow, isn't it? Not Gatwick in this. It's Heathrow, isn't it?
Right, yeah.
And both in two different time zones. So there was a lot done over at the airport here in London. Is that part, do you think, of what you'd like about it? That it has that sort of Anglo setting for, you know, certainly for the setup for the first episode?
Oh, I for sure like that. Well, I like two things about it in that respect. I do like that it's in a contemporary setting there because I enjoy when we get back to back in the days when we used to go to alien planets quite often. I enjoy the fact that you can have an episode set in an area that we know very well. So I like seeing the airport. I've been to that airport, obviously not in the 80s, but I've been to that airport and I think it's kind of cool. But I also like that it involves the Concorde, and I something about it, I like that aspect of the planes and the flight and the TARDIS is there tracking with it. I like stories that involve time travel as part of the story element, not just the fact that it takes the Doctor to the story. You know,
I also like the quintessential Davison feel to this story because it has all those elements of the squabbling crew, the way they come into the story, the way they sort of awkwardly hang out in it. It's all very very Davison. And we've got this, obviously this comes straight after Earthshock, where Adric has passed away.
Right.
So we have this unusual, well, not unusual for the era, to be fair, but unusual for Doctor Who as a whole, to have this sort of segue, strong segue from the previous story.
Yeah, you would think that they would have back then have gone to, you know, it's like a couple months later and that's over and done, you know. It's actually a nice bit of continuity that they didn't just outright forget it.
It's a nice bit for Davison here as well, because it's a very difficult, it's a difficult level to pitch here, isn't it? Because it's a sort of Saturday tea time show, or is it still Saturday, or is it Monday at this point? And it's very much obviously wanting to deal with the death, but at the same time, they don't want to dwell on it. So how do you move on from this in this one scene? And it's a nice sort of reaction that Davison has, is, you know, that, you know, it, surely, you know, idiots, if I could do what you're suggesting, I'd do it, wouldn't I? If I'm not doing it, I can't.
Which is a shame that later on in the series, in the new series anyway, he's just like, yeah, sure, I'll go ahead and do that. And it's like, oh, you just negate. Those are things that annoy me more, I guess, than certain sour story points or even ignoring it. Like, if this show had skipped over Adric's death, I think I would be less annoyed by that than them breaking that particular rule, at least them breaking that rule without any consequences to it, you know? But I like it. I do think what I like about it mainly is that there are limits to what the Doctor can do. You know, we think he's this great, powerful Time Lord, that this time machine can do anything, but there's limitations to him. And that's important because for storytelling, you need that. You can't just have him come in and do anything and everything, or else where's the story? You know, it's not interesting.
I always remember with DC, with Bruce Timm, when he was talking about the Justice League cartoon, that he always said the reason that the Flash was very limited in the first couple of seasons, because he said in the end he is the most ridiculously powerful character. You put the Flash into a story, technically he could stop anything, do anything, so it's just easy to take him out. And with Doctor Who, when you have things like the TARDIS and time travel, you've got that exact same problem. It's how do you have this such fantastical thing without it, as you say, delimiting the story from being able to create challenges or resolutions that you don't want. And yeah, I think you're right. I always like to think at this time that the Time Lords are in operation, and them being as godly as they were in the War Games. And I like to think they're the proper Time Lords, not the sort of farcical political faction they just let play out in IKEA. I like this as well, as a, you know, as a TARDIS fan, sort of materializing over the runway is a bit of fun.
Yeah.
Which again is, I think, again, it's that, it's about the fear of delimiting, isn't it? It's by making the TARDIS so erratic and make him so out of control compared to Tom Baker. It sort of adds that actual tension factor, even a silly situation like this.
Yeah. And I also really like the fact that, you know, when the Doctor needs to do something, it's not as simple as let's hop in the TARDIS, let's take that there and we're good. You know, he understands that he might not get there or might not do it right. Or even if he does try to do it, you're going to have moments like this, you know.
I like this as well. And I like the way they positioned it so the prop can just get into that light section.
Yeah, yeah.
Good landing.
You can kind of like reason that stuff out as like a fan anyway. You can reason that stuff out. The TARDIS was like, no, hold on. I got to back up just a foot.
I could turn it into a cardboard box, but I'm not going to. I'm going to go there and I'm going to stay as a police box. Deal with it.
Because I like this outfit.
Unfortunate that it chose the limited stacked roof version, where it had that extra level to the light. If it went for the later Yardley with the smaller light and small roof stack, it might have fit. No? Yeah.
Might have done.
Might have.
That was some excellent button pushing by Peter there just a second ago. That's so crazy. That's so crazy. Like, it's the 1980s and police boxes weren't anything then. Like, they were hardly around.
Yeah.
You know, and that, you think how far we've come now.
Funnily enough, you know, a lot of teenagers watching this will have actually at least seen a couple probably in their time.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, they would know that they're out of, I mean, as a kid, for me, well, I would be sort of six. I think I saw the one at Henley once when I lived near Oxford, but that was like, you know, seeing a rare bird. So, you know, it was funny being a kid watching this show in the sort of early 80s and having never seen the actual machine, the prop that the machine is based on. Sorry, the real thing the prop is based on.
And it's funny, too, when you think about it, because there's probably more, I say this, but who knows, I feel in many ways there's probably more police boxes all over England and Ireland and so on, and America right now than there ever were.
Yeah, absolutely.
Before, you know?
Absolutely. I was looking at, there is an official website over here, I'm sure you know about this, so they actually do various props to build. And they've got the range of all the eras of the police box now for about £4,000. You can get them to put together. And they are absolutely fantastic. They really are. If you've not seen it, I'll send you the link later, Brian, or we'll put it in the show notes if you've got the cash. They do Ice Warriors, they do Daleks. But they're, you know, someone who's obviously very interested in the police boxes, as you are.
Yeah.
Their attention for detail is incredible. Their Pertwee one is fantastic.
Is this... what is that one? Planet?
Yes, it is. Planet Earth.
There you are. Yes, yeah. It's Planet Earth. Yeah.
I mean, I saw their stuff a few years ago where they just did the one.
Yeah.
I thought, that's impressive. But now they've got McGann's, the Smith. They say it's the Capaldi, but it's not the Capaldi.
Sure.
It's the Smith. The Tennant, Pertwee, and the Hartnell, and the Art Jones. Oh, yes. Yeah. Fat phone.
Yeah.
I was gonna
say. This Planet Earth used to put out some pretty poor police boxes years ago, and they've really stepped up their game. A lot of their stuff looks really good now. I like the Daleks in particular. Police boxes are great, for sure, but I like their Daleks. Probably because I don't have one. And I'm jealous.
I would like to, you know, I saw the Pertwee one. I was thinking, yeah, I'd like that.
Yeah.
But, again, this is... I think, again, it's why I like the first episode of this, is you get these lovely little character moments with the three of them that you do get in the Davison era, in some of the really good stories. Well, like in Lightman, you get a lot of these sort of moments of deliberation, wandering, and... But I think this is nice, because this is the first time they've been back on Earth, really, since... Well, they were there for Legopolis, but they weren't really, if you know what I mean. It was set on Earth, but there was no real interaction with anyone on Earth. In fact, I'm trying to think when the last time that had been to Earth had been. It would probably been the Key to Time season, would it? No, sorry, City of Death, they were there. But, you know, end of the Baker era, there weren't that many that were set on, you know, interacting with contemporary Earth people.
In season 18, it started with a scene on, what, Brighton Beach? And then by the end, we got back to Earth only in the Legopolis. I think that's it.
But there was no real interaction with anyone. None of this sort of where they're actually working, dealing with contemporary people, sort of really went out with Tom Baker's. It was to say, City of Death was the only one that I can think of, apart from Stones of Blood before that, that really had a sort of contemporary interacting with people. But, I like this. It's unusual as well, the whole thing putting it in the airport. You don't really see that. And surprisingly, you don't really see that even today. I mean, you obviously get Factual Entertainments, which love airports and the likes. But having worked in an airport before, you know, they're fascinating little mini cities. So
it's interesting there with the snow as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And this is, I think, another thing which is interesting with this is that you have the first almost psychic paper use of UNIT, is you know, in the sense of using some sort of exposition tool to actually allow them to get into the story.
Oh, sure.
Without having to sort of deal too much with the fact of the police box and him appearing in the middle of the terminal and everything else. And they can just get him into the story really quickly.
It does seem like that UNIT, when they weren't a part of the story like this, they were a handy thing for the Doctor, because that was the quick move along, like you're saying, with the psychic paper. And that seems like how long could they have gotten away with that without having an occasional UNIT story to let the audience remember who they actually are, you know? But it does seem like a very handy thing to do.
I also like in this, and again, we're going back to TARDISes, but I like how it... breaks some of the sort of standard story conventions in the fact, you know, that they take the TARDIS with them. The TARDIS doesn't take them, they take the TARDIS and they store it in the Concorde. that's a lot of fun. And then you have this scene coming up, which is a lot of, which, as you know, I think is great, which deals with that whole thing about the TARDIS on its side.
Oh yes, yes, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And you think too, like a couple of years prior to this story, it probably would have just been, here's a control panel we took off the TARDIS console. We'll need this to track the flight, you know?
Yeah.
But here they go ahead and, I don't know, I guess it's a very compelling idea, like thinking, okay, we're going to fly a Concorde in this story. Well, let's put the TARDIS in it,
It makes me wonder sometimes whether at this point under Nathan Turner, whether they were sort of, because we talked when we were talking about Spared from Space last time. On one of the commentaries, we were saying how perhaps the police box wasn't quite as big a thing in sort of 1970. Perhaps it didn't carry that same sort of impact. Maybe at this point it did. Maybe it wasn't just simply the fact that you've got a standing set. Well, it's not a standing set, but yeah, you've got a set that you can just drop people into and, you know, do scenes there for little cost. So take the TARDIS along with you, it helps you along. But is it that fact that it keeps that sci-fi fantasy element in there? It keeps that excitement that kids like police boxes and TARDISes now. Like they do now. So,
well, I can tell you as a kid, you know, I would have died for a TARDIS. It would have been amazing.
Well, I've said this to you before, I think. You know, when I'd go through the Target novelizations, which was the only real thing you had for Doctor Who outside the show at the time, I'd look in the library for the ones, not just that had the TARDIS on the front cover, which meant I got the faceless ones out, which was a mistake, because the TARDIS disappears within the first scene, pretty much. But I would look through to see how many times it was mentioned. And if I was mentioned a lot, I would get that book out. That would be my first choice. If I could see that big, you know, the big letters, TARDIS in caps, throughout the book, that would interest me. So I think that it wasn't massively important. And I think also the fact, as we were saying, is because they were so unusual by this point, and especially for you, where they just didn't exist, it became even more magical. This is good as well. This actually works very well.
Yeah.
Continuity reference?
Can't argue it. There's still something about this TARDIS console room that I just adore. You know, this era. And I mean, not to downplay any of the ones in the new series. I mean, well, actually, I guess that's not fair. There's only one in the new series that I wasn't really that fond of, but they're all unique and interesting in their own way, you know. But this one, it's to me, it's as unique as the outside of the TARDIS. You know, it is the TARDIS just as much as the outside is the TARDIS.
Saying,
where the other ones, I don't feel as connected to them.
How specific are you being? Are you being specific to literally this sort of season, or are you talking about just the classic console? Are you talking about
the classic look with the roundels, the gray,
right,
and the hexagonal console? But particularly, I do care for this model as it is, this version. I really do like this one a lot. Right before they change it over, because when it gets to the five Doctors and they give it that new console, I don't mind the columns in the background being squared off. It's an interesting kind of change, you know. That's okay. I don't like the console from the five Doctors on. It's nice that it has push buttons. It seems more computerized and has a lot to do, but it also looks more like an 80s computer than it does an alien space machine. Even though this looks like, you could argue the classic consoles look more like the inside of the Concorde here. You know, they look more like a plane, you know?
Yeah.
But there's, I think what it is with the 80s console, aside from all the buttons, is it's just two panels replicated over and over. Whereas at least on these classic ones, each panel was its own unique design.
Yes.
And I think there was more thought and more interesting concepts put into those panels. Even if once in a while you got one, which was just a big screen, you know, kind of like Capaldi's and Smith's last console room. Great design. Like every panel on that thing is great, except for that one psychic panel where like Clara had to stick her fingers in. Like that's the only thing, that's the only failing point on that console for me. Everything else looks really nice on that console.
Which, of course, that side of the console is heavily influenced by the 80s console. Panel side that
sure
that you dislike, so
there you go. That's funny.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Oh dear. I mean, a lot of people complain about this. Is the CSO effects at the time weren't quite very, but I think you can get past, especially since there's a lot of psychic imagery in this.
You know, I think the sad thing is I see things like this, And I sit there and I look at movies like, you know, Lord of the Rings, Gollum, the new Star Wars movie with Maz Kanata, and pretty much every one of the prequels movies. And I say, like, these people can watch these movies and they're okay looking at these CGI people, which look to me like you're watching Roger Rabbit. You know, it's like, it doesn't look like a proper mix. Like, they don't look real to me. They look like cartoons. And yet they'll complain about this. Like, it's to me, that kind of stuff, like, I can watch, even though I think they look like cartoons, I watch them, I get what they're trying to do, they got their point across, I understand the scene. It's the exact same thing here. Like, yeah, you can tell it's CSO, you know there's going to be a change, but it's okay. It's they're telling a story, just watch the story, you know? Like, I don't grade the effects, I guess, that way in most places.
Well, there is an argument, and I think it's a very strong argument, because I've just really thought it up, is that in the end, as soon as you have something which is spectacle, yeah, by almost by definition, you don't believe it. As soon as something exists on the screen which goes outside what you expect, you automatically, just by rationale of it being different, well, you will not, your brain doesn't accept it. All it sure can do is make a value judgment upon how close to what you'd imagine it would be, it is. So ultimately, whether you've got Golem there as a CGI monster or whether you've got a guy in a suit, you're still going to have that same reaction. This is not real. How good is this? It doesn't really take you out of the scene per se, because you'll never get past the fact. Every time you see Gollum, your brain will be thinking, I really like how they managed to do that there. I didn't not believe in it, but obviously I didn't, because I've already just said that.
Sure.
And that is a very interesting situation to be in, that you can never truly reconcile it. So does it really matter?
It comes down to the one thing I always say, is that nowadays people seem to have forgotten that when you watch any kind of film, any kind of show, you need a certain amount of suspension of disbelief. It's always necessary. And a lot of people expect everything to be perfectly 100% accurate or real. And that's something that's like criticism that I hear a lot with certain things. It's like, oh, it took me right out because of this. And it's like, really? Like, you do understand suspension of disbelief is necessary, you know? But I will say, going back to that CSO scene, you could even argue it wasn't necessary, because they had them on a, like, in one scene, they were actually there. They were actually on the tarmac. And then the next scene, it's a CSO shot of them on the tarmac. And then the scene switches and they're on the set. They didn't even do like a CSO shot to a CSO shot. They just disappeared them to a different set. So all they had to do was just film them on the other set.
See,
and then reappear them on the second set.
I mean, we're talking about the same issue again, but I think the sort of layering to this set is actually very effective.
Oh, I love this set. This is the thing that I don't understand. If this is what people are complaining about, I love this. I know it's a set. I know that's a backdrop cloth back there, but I love it. I think it's great. And when they just showed that other downed ship in the background, it's kind of funny, because I don't even remember that downed ship in the background. I was just sitting here while we were talking. I was like, wow, that thing looks really cool, you know? It's neat. And I know it's tough, because when you go to show the Concorde in this setting, it's, again, it's CSO, or you just get a close-up of the tire or something like that. Mm-hmm. I don't mind that, though. Go on.
So should we just ask how you feel about, because people who are listening to this presumably have watched it, how you felt about Amy's performance in this first episode? Because this is, again, taking on the same thing as the Portreeve. We're playing that same game here, and they're playing the gambit. Can they hide who this character is?
I will say...
That's good as well. That's all right. Sorry.
Yeah, that's really great. That's what I'm saying. I don't have an issue with any of this stuff. I love it. I love seeing Alien World sets like this. I've said 100 times, like, rather than a new series or any series, just do Earth-based stories, because they feel they can't realize Alien Worlds. I would much rather them use their brain, be creative, and give us a set like this. I don't care if it's fake. Like, I believe it. You know, like, I always mention the Planet of Evil. That's one of my favorite Alien World sets in Doctor Who, you know? It's great, and I love this one, too. But in answer to your question, I think this one... This is going to sound terrible because I don't mean it this way, so I don't want to say it that way. Okay, I think this version of Ainley's performance is very effective. Why is he trying to hide himself? Who knows? I'll have to watch the story and see if I can remember why that was even necessary. But I think it's effective because I can't tell it's him. Unlike when we were watching Castrovalva, you know, to me, it's quite obvious that's Ainley there. But it's great because it's a wonderful performance by Ainley, clearly playing a different character. But it's kind of like watching Johnny Depp play either Captain Jack Sparrow or Willy Wonka or something like that. You know it's Johnny Depp, but they're clearly two different great performances, you know? So that's what it is here. Rather than Ainley playing the master, playing this character, that's not what I'm thinking. I'm picturing more so Ainley playing this other character, and you know it's Doctor Who, you know he's going to end up being the master, but with this mask, I can't tell it's him, unlike the portrait where I could. I like it. I don't know. What do you think?
No, I think it's good. I think his face mask is very good indeed. It hides his features very, very well. And especially again, you've got to remember at this time, people won't be that familiar with him.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
I mean, he'd have only been in a, well, obviously keep a try the trilogy
Yeah.
up to Castrofalva. Then it was this. That's fun. Okay, so that's the end of part one. What we're going to do is we will take a very short break. You won't notice anything, and then we'll count you down for part two. So, is there anything over these credits that you want to mention? I really can't think of anything. I still think that's the best part of the lot. I really enjoy that. There's a lot of variation in it. It feels its own beast at this point. Doctor Who has changed, and but it feels very comfortable with the change.
Yeah, it did a lot of great things. Started, well, I guess I started elsewhere, but basically you have the TARDIS scene, you have the grieving over Adric, and then you kind of get them lopped into a story where something's going on, and it's in, you think Heathrow, and as a matter of fact, probably watching this story without seeing a trailer for it, I would have just thought something's going on at Heathrow Airport. I probably would have thought it was more so like the Faceless Ones. And then you get taken away, and I think that's great. I think it's wonderful to see those two different areas. And I like the fact too that they're also, rather than using contemporary characters in a contemporary setting, they took contemporary characters and they took them with us to a different setting.
Yeah,
I think that's a lot of fun.
I think that makes it interesting as well. Right,
Yeah.
okay, we will be back in a couple of seconds. As I say, you won't notice anything, but I'm saying this more for us so we can be prepared for our disassociationship with yourselves as we prepare ourselves for part two. Right, so you can edit. And on we go to part two. So we'll count you down again in case you've taken a break like we did. Five, four, three, two. I don't know why I'm doing it like this. One and go. So here we go. This is part two, the same adventure. I was tempted to put on a different adventure and see if I could sort of create a sort of syncopation between you talking about time flight while I talked about, I don't know.
That would be hilarious. We should do that
That
one
would have
day.
been very good if I hadn't actually mentioned it. If
I
I'd
have to
done.
say too, this I know I say it all the time, but this
Yeah.
intro, nothing gets me more hyped for a Doctor Who episode than this 80s intro
I
for
love
some
this
reason.
80s
I love
intro.
this one.
I love everything about this 80s intro.
Yeah.
The music, I think the effects are simple and
Yeah.
effective. And it's an interesting sound that it carries, excitement, and it carries a bit of flair to it, and yet it has a certain malevolence to it as well.
Yeah.
The end a vacuum sound as it prepares for the episode is quite cold and chilling.
And I like that it fades into the episode a lot, and certainly, as we said, the outro, the sting
Yes,
just
the
works so
sting, yes,
perfectly.
especially if they, let's
Yeah.
say get them to see to scream in key to get that sting is.
Yeah.
Yeah,
It's
it's.
kind of, on one hand, you look at things like this with Anthony Ainley there, and it is kind of, it's great that it's a disguise, but on the other hand, it's kind of like, wow, he could have been a character all on his own. Like, this story probably didn't even need the master, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. There's probably a few, probably not that many shout outs of people who've been in Doctor Who or characters who've been in Doctor Who which could have gone on and didn't, or ones that did and shouldn't. Yeah, he could have made a return. I mean, Syl made a return. I never was actually that taken with Syl. I thought he was a little
No.
overplayed.
Yeah. I agree. He was good for the story they had him in, and then bringing him back was, I'll tell you what, we I mean, we're on this story, but whatever. We talked about the Trial of Time Lord before, how Doctor Who took a break. It took a lot of criticism, and then they bring the show back, but they didn't really seem to change anything. You know, they changed the format back to 24 minutes. They still had the Doctor and companion bickering, where the Doctor, where Colin and Nicola had to take it upon themselves to stop that or make it sound like banter, friendly banter. But then they bring back other elements like Syl, you know, from things that just didn't really seem to work for me, you know? I don't know. Where this story, and maybe it has faults, I'm real curious to hear when we're going to get there, but this story is one of the moments I think, like, really works for me in Nathan Turner's era. I think it's an interesting concept, and I don't feel it's overly... Like here, this lighting on this planet looks really nice. A lot of episodes that I can remember in this era suffered a lot from like harsh studio lighting. Maybe that's even my memory. Maybe they're more well lit than I'm remembering.
Yeah, it's I don't think the lighting's too bad in this.
No, this is good. I mean, I enjoy this. I enjoy the setup. I like the way everything's cloudy in the background. Mm-hmm. And it looks almost like they're lit underneath a cloudy sky, you know, rather than like seeing yellow lights on their faces. It feels more like a gray zone on them.
Absolutely.
And there's old Matt Smith there. I do remember too. What was it? What was that story? Full Circle.
Yeah.
Romana talks about how heavy the TARDIS is and that nobody could move that, and then we're supposed to believe that the Marshmen are like super strong because of how heavy Romana calculated the TARDIS weighed at. But in stories prior to and after it, people are just picking it up left and right.
There was some. I can't remember what story it was. There was something which tried to argue that it was had a variable weight factor that you could change the weight as you required, which
I suppose that would make sense. If you land on like a if you land say in a hurricane, you're going to want it to be heavier. Oh, that would make a lot of sense, because there's also, what was the story, was it Fury from the Deep where it lands on water?
Yes.
And then, of course, Marco Polo and his crew are able to put it on a wagon, carry it along.
No, it's it's one of those inconsistencies that you just really have to deal with.
Oh yeah. I was just talking about that today, and I was saying that TV show like Breaking Bad is a great show. Not by any means my favorite show, but I always say it is the most well-written show I've ever seen. But like, I will take a TV show like Doctor Who or The X-Files, warts and all, with their inconsistencies and continuity, because they appeal to me more, you know? And not to downplay Breaking Bad. Like I said, it was a fantastic show. I'd recommend anybody check it out. But it is funny how one show can be so perfect and keep all their ducks in a row so well, and other ones just falter left, right, and sideways. But to me, they hit home to me more. You know, it's just more my interest area is basically what it comes down to.
Yeah, there's some incredible backdrops in this.
Yeah. It looks like, if you look at where Peter is standing right now, it looks like the set literally goes that far off into the horizon.
Yeah, absolutely.
For him, it doesn't look like it's a set with a cloth behind it. These are why I love this episode for those things. I really love the fact that they didn't just stick them in a quarry and say it was an alien planet. Although I enjoy that because I like seeing when they're quite legitimately outside. But I like that they went ahead and they were creative. It looks really nice.
No, yeah, I totally agree. You could have easily done this with a quarry, couldn't you? And it's good job they didn't.
That's why, like, one of the things with Time in the Rani, I know we're kind of harsh on that story, but I give him major credit for making the sky pink in that story. You know, I think that's fun. I think they even did that in Mind Warp, too, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think Mind Warp's pretty much the first one I can remember where they started heavily using filters to... And I think, again, it's something they're very lucky with that you can do these days, is you can create such filter and post effects that you can hide so much of the... problems or the inconsistencies that come from, obviously even down onto a studio floor, different lightings can create, you create an overall tone which sits very nicely, which you
And I
just
gotta
don't
give
have
some
in.
major credit to the art department here. I mean, she looks like she's actually up against a real rock. Like, we know it's fake because we know the set is fake, and until we see it rumble, it looks like it's a real rock face. It looks really good.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, good old Issa. She doesn't have much fun this season, does she, really?
She gets a rough time. She gets one episode where she had a headache, so she stayed out the whole
So she
episode.
stayed out the whole
Yeah.
episode, yeah. One story episode suggests
Story,
it's one whole story. And then back, what did I miss? Yes, it was a.
All right, if we're gonna nitpick one thing, I mean, on one hand, I don't mind it, but really, somebody was like, let's just use soap suds as an effect for our creatures. Like, no one will notice that. But at the same time, who's to say some alien thing doesn't use something that looks like soap suds, you know?
It doesn't look too bad when they do the overlay. It looks a little bad when it sort of forms on them, but the overlay is actually quite effective.
If they could get it to form over them, like if they could have done an effect where you actually saw the bubbles like individually forming over them, I think that would be pretty great. But I agree, like just kind of size overlaying on top of a person doesn't work quite as well.
I always think one of the funny things with television at this time, and they now don't have to worry about it, but they should have done more of this time, is you don't need transitions. You could turn round and she could just be covered. You don't need to have something come down and affect them.
Oh yeah.
You could to get rid of a lot of special effects logistical problems by having things have just happened where you can just don't have to do the transition. Which nowadays it's not so much so expensive to do transitions, so it doesn't really matter. But then, where everything was a little more rough and ready.
You know, as an independent filmmaker, it's a technique that I would have used because one thing that I always do is whenever I write to my limitations, and I know we don't have a huge special effects budget. So, how do you get around these things? And you quite literally can write around them easily and not have it even look cheap, which is what's great about it. You know, if you do the concept interestingly enough. So you could have, I agree, just done exactly what you said there, just cut back to her and she's covered, and that would have been a shock element too for both the character and the audience.
Absolutely.
I like the finish on this wall, this ship, whatever they're cracking into.
Yes. No, it's nice, isn't it? It's
Yeah.
the rest of the set is perhaps.
Yeah.
I'm though again, sort of talking about dealing with your limitations, they've dealt with it very nicely there by just having black behind rather than having to. There's limits to the set that they just sort of accept, and black often just does your job, doesn't it? You can't really argue with black. You can't say it looks wrong or it looks flat or it looks out of perspective. It's just black.
It's weird, I'll tell you what. Like even today, they'll use on big budget films, they'll use a similar technique where they don't have the budgets to make the sets. They'll go ahead and fool you in other ways. And I just watched recently Into Darkness, Star Trek Into Darkness, and there's this huge hallway scene where Scotty is running down
Yeah, I
trying to
remember.
let Kirk and Khan into the spaceship. And the spaceship, it's not a set that they built. It was a hangar bay where they said they originally built the Spruce Goose. And the walls are like green and kind of orange and like other colors and so on. But once they just painted the floor black, put in a few objects in the background, and shot it with purposeful lighting, all those walls, you can still make out the basic shape of the hangar bay walls, but they just look black, like the interior of the ship, like they wanted them to be. And they may have put a bit more post-production work onto that, but they were even saying like when they did it, you just couldn't even tell the actual colors were there. And I think that's incredible to think that like a set with a budget like that would go ahead and do something as cheaply as a TV show like Doctor Who probably would have once done, and it's still an effective method, you know? So yeah, I agree. Just throwing like black back there is way better than trying to put some like half haphazard rocks behind that don't quite hold up as well as the rest.
I always found with the new Star Trek in their sets was I could never reconcile the use of the sort of power plant for the engines of the Enterprise with the upper levels. It just never quite worked for me. I know it's a sort of very naval vessel approach, but there was just a disconnect. I couldn't mentally connect them. I couldn't make that suspension of disbelief, I suppose. So maybe,
I didn't have as much of an issue with you in that respect. However, I did feel that it was a little bit odd changing it so drastically from what we knew. You know, I would have preferred if it was kind of more like the classic kind of engine rooms that we're used to, even if they went with a more kind of next generation look kind of thing. You know, it's not, I mean, how much money would that have cost to have built an engine room set, you know? But I didn't mind it so much. I think some of the visuals in there looked good. When they showed how dual layer it was, then it was all of a sudden like, whoa, that's a little weird.
Yeah, so.
But I think close-ups work. You know what I mean? Like cells. And I think that's what you can do in some of the things like this. Like sets here where some of the areas don't work. You just find the angles where they do, and that's all you use.
Yeah.
You know, and that's all they had to do in both cases there.
And they do very well here. I think these sets are really very strong. They complement. They don't over. I think the problem sometimes with science fiction is that you spend so much time trying to make the things look different and original that they end up overpowering, and you're constantly distracted by the set, either because it looks too good or very rarely, unfortunately, for Doctor Who, but normally because it just looks too wrong. But this sort of muted colours, these blacks and sort of reddies that are within the Master's Lair, are very, very work very well. They give that lovely contrast with your main characters. But it's a good mask, that.
Very good mask.
But no, I like the red. There's a lot of interesting sort of red colours in this place. I like some unusual choices of. I'm not sure I'm over keen on the globe, the Master's globe thing, but
I think what I like about his globe there is that this guy that he's trying to portray, we're meant to be looking at him as if he's some kind of mystical, magical kind of person, and there's that crystal ball that helps portray that.
True.
But clearly that crystal ball is mechanical. It's a machine, you know, which kind of gives away the Master's game a little bit, you know, and maybe they could have had the Doctor play up to that a little bit more, but
do you think,
I like that aspect of it.
Do you think this is the thing that a lot of people find the problem with Time Flyers, not just sort of patchiness as they found with some of the effects, but the sort of general gist of the Master's plan being a bit... I'd say that it's wacky for him, but in this sort of era, it really isn't.
Yeah. It's not that crazy for him in this era, no. And, you know, it's what's also strange for me is I say I like this story, and I do. It's weird that I watch this one quite a bit. I can't remember what his goal is right now.
Is that a problem? I can't remember. It must have been a while since I've seen it. But
In order to speak about whether or not it's a good or a bad goal, I'd like to know what it is so I can say one way or the other, you know. But it's kind of weird. I don't... Like, I from what I remember of this story, he's going to eventually want parts of the Doctor's TARDIS because his isn't working right. So I had assumed in some way he was trapped here. And not only that, he wanted power from what's behind this wall that they're all trying to break into. I mean, that's usually his goal is I want power. But I also felt he was trapped. And
he's frequently trapped in this era, though, isn't he?
Yeah.
A frequent route for him.
It's hilarious, too, because at one point he's got two TARDISes and then, you know, he's trapped here. He's just got the one. I guess we blew up the other one, though, didn't we? Keeper Truck, and that one got destroyed and he escaped in the second.
Because that was inside his Melka thing, wasn't it? It was in the background, didn't he?
Because even the Doctor says at one point that he had a second TARDIS.
Yes, he does. That's true.
Yeah. So
you've had a second TARDIS, you do.
Yeah, you know, why not? Then you get to the new series and doesn't even have a one.
No, you've got these vortex manipulators. It's like, so why have a telephone line when you can have a mobile phone?
That is an incredibly apt analogy for the TARDISes. That's wonderful.
It feels that way.
The
way the vortex manipulators are used in the... new series, which is fine, but as we've said before, it does sort of cheapen time travel a bit.
Yeah, no, absolutely it does. I would just prefer the Master actually have a TARDIS again, just because it's something that's unique to the Time Lords, and it seems strange that one of them's traveling without it. If they weren't going to have a TARDIS for the Master rather than the Vortex Manipulator, I would have been much happier if they had the Master with a time ring. Something at least Time
Yeah.
Lord technology that seems more controllable than the Vortex Manipulator, which the Doctor made it sound like it was a harsh way to travel. And I guess the Master's not going to care about that. But I think a time ring would have been a cooler aspect, something that we don't quite fully know the limitations of.
Well, I think you'd have a TARDIS just simply because there you have a mobile home unit for sort of your laboratory mechanics,
Oh,
temporal
I'm with you.
power. You wouldn't just be constantly.
Oh, I'm with you, and I would prefer it's a TARDIS, but I'm
Yeah,
saying if in the
yeah.
new series they didn't want him to
No,
have a
I yeah.
TARDIS, I
But
would have shot for the time ring.
it's funny how they've stuck with that. There's the sort of lone Time Lord, the last of the Time Lords, so it's got to be the last TARDIS as well, as if that's something that's of course they've broken that now with the you can't give the Master a TARDIS, but Clara, yeah, you can give her a TARDIS if she
Of
can get, and
course.
that's fine, absolutely. I don't know. I think sometimes, no matter how professional you are as a writer, when you're a fan of something, the sort of that sort of amateur, that true love of something which goes beyond its practical nature as a product starts to seep in like an aspirin dissolving in water or an anti-aspirin, and things like giving Clara her TARDIS at the end and the TARDIS having to be the Hartnell sort of TARDIS is a bit very, very, you could feel the person's passion and love for his characters and his love for the show come bleeding through. But interesting enough, a while not long ago, I was speaking to Gareth Cavanagh, and he was saying how he'd had time.
Oh, Christ. Sorry. I live with dogs now.
Oh God, I forgot we have a there's a Matthew Waterhouse scene in this one, isn't there? I think there's a few technical problems our end. There we go. Yeah, it's Thran's a little off base. A little off base.
I remember thinking this was the only part of the story that I. It's like both good and both I would have let it go kind of thing. Like here, this character just had a death scene in the show, and it
Yeah.
was. And in fairness, it was actually a good death scene. He tried to do the right thing and it didn't work out. I mean, effectively, in the end, it did work out, but it didn't work out the way he was hoping for it to work out, And then you bring him back in the next story to basically try to be a foil in some way to the other two companions. It works. It's interesting because it is good that like the Master would have used him in such a way like that, or whoever these creatures are using, getting into their heads to use them like that. But I think after ending the show with silence over the credits the last week, I would have, or 2 weeks ago, I would have left Adric out of the story.
There's a lot of continuity moments here. I've totally forgotten about them.
And it's kind of weird though when you think about it though, these continuity elements, they're not just being thrown in for the sake of continuity, they're familiarity. Like the audience would have just seen them and knows to be afraid of them. So it's easy to write them in rather than create something new that they need to be afraid of in those scenes, which would have been great to see something new, but budgetary restraints, you can just say, hey, let's just use those familiar aspects.
And
Let's take
cheaper
those
as
things
well.
we have in storage because it's going to save us money. But you're not throwing it in. You're not throwing it in for the sake of a cheap reference. You're actually trying to scare the characters with something that they already know, so it works in that respect.
No, it's yeah, I'm all, sorry, what I was going to say, I got distracted by your dogs. Speaking to Gareth Cavanagh, who spoke to spent time chatting to Eric Soward. And it was just nice to hear him. He was saying how nice Eric was and how very modest and quite I wouldn't say insecure, but quite thoughtful about his work there. I mean, a lot of people sort of he's personified, especially in fandom, as being quite a harsh, brutal man who was very inflexible and didn't want to change much. And then obviously had his big row with John Nathan Turner and ended with the Trial of the Time Lord. But he's just a very, very gentle, very sweet guy. He's, I think, fairly amazed that people still talk about his work here.
You know, I think that's good to hear. And I think like some of these people get a bad rap because you kind of see them mainly on bad days or hear about their bad days rather than hear about all their good days, you know. So it is good to hear a positive thing about him, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Go on.
You said he had some very interesting stories about John Nathan Turner as well. But
sure.
Yeah, interesting.
That's an effect there with the
yes.
The master falling apart. Like, why would that outfit have... That's something I would like to explain. Why did his outfit fail so badly? Was he somehow connected to this equipment in such a way?
Maybe the outfit was floated by green goo on the inside, like an inflatable...
Could have been, I suppose, like an organic outfit. Like maybe it was almost like it was a living creature on top of himself. You know, not like a mental creature, but more like a flesh suit, kind of like, I guess, the Slitheen. But like rather than being a regular old makeup effect the master would do, here's this living, breathing flesh that he's wearing. Sounds gross. Sounds really like he's a cannibal or something like that. But what if it was like generated by a machine that it's just like this living skin that you can wear?
Yeah.
That would be an interesting thing. Because, I mean, think about it. Stuff like that, it wasn't written in the script, no. Coming up with this idea after the fact, yes. But it's way more interesting to think that the master is using some kind of technology that we're unaware of rather than just a latex mask that you can get on Earth. You know?
I think that's fun. I love as well how he's wearing the same costume as he always wears as well. I know it was part of the visual iconography of the time from Nathan Turner's point of view that they should all have set outfits.
Yeah.
But it's kind of funny to think he was wearing that under that all that time.
and also in fairness, like Delgado did have a particular outfit that he wore often, but it was nice to see that they could put him in a nice suit. Like the only time we saw Ainley in a nice suit, it wasn't even him. You know, it was a chameleon for whatever reason, thinking I need to wear this nice suit, you know. it's kind of weird. But yeah, no, I think I like Ainley's outfit as the master. But I wouldn't have minded seeing like once in a blue moon that nice suit kind of thing, like especially when he's on Earth, you know.
He has that nice suit in Survival.
Oh yeah, that's a great outfit. So. That's right. That was a great exit outfit.
Right, okay, well, we'll be moving on to part three, so if you guys can just hold on and we will sort ourselves out, and be back in a second. Right, we're about to go into part three. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1... Here we go. And off we start again. Back to the same exciting intro. Is your part three working there, Brian?
Yes.
It is good. It is good there, yeah. It's funny to think, what was this, 1981, really? It was first season, wasn't it? 1981, 82.
Sorry for the clicking.
It's a long time ago. So, yeah, March 1982.
How long after this episode did Concorde stop doing flights?
Concorde,
like, when did that actually happen?
Concorde's flights carried on for a long time, didn't they? I mean, obviously, from France, they certainly did. But Concorde here in the UK, certainly, let's have a look. Concorde. Well, we'll have a look as we carry on. I probably shouldn't at this moment. We should have done the research earlier, but there we go. Yeah, obviously, Concorde went on for a while because it was several years ago now, but there was that terrible crash, remember, with the France side where the Concorde went into the building.
Right.
That was when it was still running. That was a terrible moment. So, yeah, here we have our recap of our surprise that it's actually Anthony Ainley. Behind him, because it's not the master, it's his arch enemy Anthony Ainley. keeps appearing in his show even though he's not cast. The Doctor can't believe it. It's just, how could he not tell? How did he not know it was Anthony Ainley? Keeps coming on, dressing up, tricking him with his little phallic gun. It's a weird thing.
There we go. I like that. I like that they talk about that crystal ball. Essentially, it was just a telepathic circuit kind of thing.
There we go. That explains it all.
Yeah. So, like, that whole setup doesn't even have to be electrical equipment. All it has to do is just hold that globe up, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's pretty cool.
I like the idea that he's actually made it from bits of previous aircrafts that he's had.
Yes.
There. So, like, it looks like that could be one of the vacuum cleaner pieces from the cabin area that he might have taken apart and made the leverage sections.
And when you think about it, he could have even made his disguise from one of the previous occupants, too. Not to, again, get I keep getting morbid with the master, but, you know, could have modeled his disguise on one of the other aliens. Because when you think about it, the doctor didn't, saw Khalid and didn't question, like, you know, who are you, what race are you? It obviously must have been somewhat familiar to the doctor, you know?
Mm.
So it could have been a race he had encountered before. We always talk about the TARDIS here, but
I know.
That particular scene where the doctor hands off the TARDIS key on a string, you know, as a TARDIS key collector, yeah, I know, it's a niche, but hey, whatever. It was nice to know, oh, look, his can be differentiated by a little piece of string.
Yes, it's a nice little scene. Again, if we're going to go into police boxes, he was using the back side of that box again, the ulterior doors there. So it's frequently done in this season. The same as Kinder, which follows, actually, isn't it? Kinder 4.
It is funny, though, because I just remember for years not knowing that. And I used to think, you know, using my younger logic, you know, in my earlier days, that for some reason that center divide was separable and you could attach it to whatever door you wanted. Because it was like, why does it sometimes open that way and sometimes open this way? You know, didn't even think it would have two sets of doors.
Well, I'm impressed that you noticed it. As a young guy, I don't think I did.
Oh, no? Yeah, I don't. I mean, I don't think, like, I'm talking probably teenage years rather than younger than that kind of years. But yeah, I don't. It was just something it's one of those weird things you fixate on, I guess, when you're watching it.
Oh, absolutely. Like, when we all get them, I've been fixated. I was going back to Planet Earth, who I was looking at earlier, not trying to promote them in any way at all. I doubt many people here could afford what they're selling, but I was looking at some of their boxes, and they did one actually from this era, which I never noticed on theirs, which I'll have to watch again. The central divide actually seems to go up somehow past the actual police box sign and sits actually on the roof, comes up through onto the roof section, which
what?
Is
really,
I've never noticed that. So I mean, since they're so keen on accuracy, and I feel bad almost like I'm promoting them, but we do it for Big Finish, so I suppose no reason not to. But yeah,
if they hold the official license, there's nothing wrong.
Yeah, absolutely, they've got a license for it. But yeah, I would, it's very, very odd. It's because I'd never noticed it before, and yet I can't imagine that they've done it wrong, because they're obviously, the rest of their boxes are extremely tight. As we're talking, I'm going to email Brian the link so he can see what you guys can't. But yeah, no, it's funny how I think what is interesting these days is that, you know, before, I mean, there's always these things about nerds and, you know, train spotting, and there's all these sort of generalizations that were sort of homogenizing and devaluing a certain set of people into this one archetype. And yeah, as the internet sort of exploded and people were able to communicate, and it was lovely to find that you were not the only one. You were not the only one who had these small nuances. And it might not be to do with trains or TARDISes. It could be to do with, you know, football shirts over over a club's continuity, over its period, its history. You know, fixations in our lives come from everywhere. And it's just interesting when you find people who found similar fixations as you've got.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm trying to keep my keyboard quiet, but I have to get back into my mail.
Good luck on that.
Yeah, it's a loud keyboard over here. What's going on there?
No, I think I still prefer this console room to the new ones. I think there's always a problem these days is that, and it goes to everything. I mean, obviously, you being a comic fan as well, it also obviously comes by the sort of late 80s, certainly by the 90s. we've talked about this before, as we always have, so splash panels became very big, and everything had to be overblown, and characters had to be overblown, everything has to be oversized.
Yeah.
And it was kind of, and that's the same in television, you know, a TARDIS console room couldn't be this size. Because it's bigger on the inside, it has to be significantly bigger on the inside, to a point where it takes a ridiculous amount of setup.
Sure.
To a point where, especially I think with Davis's era, they started to kind of regret having this ridiculous large set that they didn't really couldn't really film in any other angles than that one pretty much fixed side. While something small like this does the same job, it's still bigger than the outside, and I don't know. Is it just me? I'm just trying to work out now. Am I just being old-fashioned? Am I just nostalgic? I just feel this. These sort of smaller sets work.
Yeah, well, it's kind of weird when you think about it, because you go to like Tom Baker's era, where you talk about that the TARDIS could essentially be the size of a civilization in there, you know, an entire city or a planet even. But the console room is still a nice small area, you know. Hartnell's era, you pretty much have the console room, a power room, and then some sleeping rooms, you know, and maybe you extend a little bit further beyond there. And I'm cool with that, you know. But then you get to like Russell T. Davis's era. And they make the console room. It's essentially just a larger version of this classic room. They just made it more spacious. It was taller, where we could actually see the top of the roof. But it's still just a control room. There's nothing else to it. It's just a control room. It's just big. And you would think, going by how big they made it, that we would have seen how big the rest of the ship was. Because clearly they have the money to show us how big this room could be. But they don't. So, like, until you get to, like, episode 3 of that first series, when he tells Rose, you know, go back there to the wardrobe, you don't really, as a fan, as a new fan, not knowing how big that ship is, you don't really know that it's not just a console room. Mm. And that's kind of interesting, you know, and it's nice to learn slowly that it's bigger. But this classic room, to me, like, when you think about what TARDISes are, they're a space-time ship for Time Lords, you know, and that idea that they were meant to be flown by six operators has been around for a while, and it was only ever in, I guess, Russell T. Davis's era where it was set on screen officially. When you think about the idea that there's just supposed to be six people standing around working these consoles, going wherever they're thinking. Going.
Well, we see Anthony Ainley there at the console, one of the panels nearest to us. I was just imagining being the person operating that panel, because it's like six buttons on it and at this time and one dial, and you could be there for like weeks on end with just those six buttons. But sorry, carry on.
Well, no, what also gets me though is it's like, not only are they just like buttons there, but there's no markings.
No,
there's just no screen. Like, you're just like, you know, okay, hit the temporal stabilizer. All right, well, shit, I got six buttons and one dial. Wait, hit the temporal stabilizer, we're gonna die if you don't. But they're not. Oh shit, I'm just gonna press this one. It always gets me that. I mean, it's the same way in all sci-fi. They're not people. Absolutely. Everybody just knows what they're doing. But what I like about the room is it looks more realistic, that you open those doors, you're going to get into a control room, which is just functional, you know, and it looks neat to us, but to Time Lords, it would just be functional. They just need to get where they're going and get back home, you know, maybe use some TARDIS power to fix something. Who knows? But, you know, we know the Time Lords don't travel in them extensively. We know that they don't, use them, really. They hide in them, you know. That said, and I know that we did get to see what a classic series console room could look
Ainley's,
like.
Sorry, I love Ainley's bat of the door control there. It's irritated. He bats it forward rather than you hold it. Sorry, carry on.
No. It's always great when you can do that. Ainley, he's such a joy to watch. I love his master. I really do. And these two guys just, you know, who knows? What could they be doing right now to removing all these panels from the console? Like, you know, they could have ended this story so soon.
Yes.
But no, I know that we got to see what a classic series console room looked like in, what was it, Series 9, the end of Series 9. But I would really like to see them do a classic-inspired console room where it looks a hell of a lot like the current one we're looking at right now, but we actually get to see the ceiling. Maybe it's a closed off set, the way the Capaldi set is completely an enclosure, you know. Mm-hmm. This way it can feel more real, I guess. Like right now it feels like a TV set. I mean, not to knock it, I love this set, but it feels like a TV set in the classic sense that it's a four-walled room, or three-walled room. The fourth wall is us. it would be great to see a more realistic version of it in the new series, because I don't think one of these classic ones would work quite as well, because you'd have to make it hold up to, I guess, the high def TV and also modern angles and so on. I think it doesn't need a lot to work, but I would like to see them kind of realize it a
little bit more.
So you're talking
about more like the, I mean, because obviously, as you say, Hellbent had a classic, obviously, base, that obviously being the one from Adventures in Time and Space and the Exhibition. But this sort of, so I think what is interesting here is this, I think there's two things you said I think is interesting is that when you have something that's bigger on the inside, one of the ways that, you know, is a functionality is, I think what makes this feel big on the inside is because you have that side door into the interior where you just get the hint of space moving out.
Yeah.
So you can have quite a small set here. And yet because you've got that extra door, which suggests more following out, it feels bigger without it having to be bigger. And you can keep things localized to a small set. I think also the other thing I like about what you said is the functionality. If you take Capaldi's room, it is horrendously ostentatious. In the sense, and not even in the, not really, I don't even sure that's really the right word, because it still feels almost like it's meant to be practical, because it's not really decorative, having the second rail, second tier walkway and the lower walkways, but it's not actually functional either. It feels like it needs to be there, but it has no purpose. So it feels sort of unnecessary. It's not even a space that people could really hang in. It's not a space that people could work in. It's not a space that people could enjoy living in particularly.
Yeah.
So again, it feels big for no reason. While if it was smaller, like this one, I mean, this one feels small and perhaps pokey. But like you say, if you had a small set of Time Lords living in a perhaps even a smaller bubble of TARDIS size, because you wouldn't need an infinite TARDIS, with your sort of rooms off your laboratory, your science room, and your living quarters, and then you'd work in this TARDIS, land in a time zone disguised as, I don't know, Anthony Ainley's favorite plant pot, and you'd watch everything going on, and you know, and then you'd head off back home. You wouldn't need anything that size. You wouldn't need anything that's a scale. It's in a way, it feels more realistic, even though it looks cheaper, and even though it's done for practical purposes. Because obviously, as we know, in the Hartnell era, this sort of same set was a lot bigger, and then they localized it to this. It still works for me. And I know we've talked about this before. I still think the interface of having those doors to the police box doors work in the sense that they don't work. Because they make no sense. It makes the TARDIS feel more nonsense and therefore almost more in tune with high technology. That there is no way you can reconcile those outer doors to the inner world. And that's good to me because it's meant to be so high technology. Why would you have such straightforward interfaces? I don't think you'd have to. Like there, where the master walks into his column, you never see how he walks in, just goes behind it, he's gone.
Yeah.
I like that, because this is, you know, unworldly stuff. It's un-universe-y stuff.
Yeah, and you get into, I think it's like the Three Doctors. They leave the TARDIS, and they run out of the TARDIS when that bubble creature is there. I forget the name of those things. And you can see inside the box is complete black, you know, so like you get to Father's Day in the new series and you see the inside of the police box looks exactly like the outside of the police box. And it's kind of like, to him, it's a big shocker. And it's like, that's a shame, because once upon a time, just seeing black inside the TARDIS wasn't an issue because it was a threshold. And I liked the concept of it, that to me, it was less like the TV movie in the respect that you're crossing from one phase of the box to another over this temporal threshold, which is a great way to look at it. I don't mind that. I like that aspect. But to me, it was more so part of the disguise. Here's the TARDIS that disguises itself as a police box. And if you open those doors, if you don't know that that's a spaceship and you open those doors, it should still keep up the disguise and look like an interior of a police box.
Yeah.
And if you were to step inside that interior of the police box and cross the threshold and then you end up in the console room, then you can be shocked as hell, rather than opening the doors in the new series and seeing that this box clearly hides a bigger secret once the doors are open. So I like that kind of Time Lord technology aspect of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of the classic series anyway, and how I would view it. It's never truly said, but it's more so how I would view it, you know, and I like that.
I like the freedom of that. I like it, yeah.
And it's a shame, because can you go back to that in the new series now that you've shown so many where you can see directly in the box?
I don't know, because Hellbent, I mean, okay, to be fair, Hellbent still did the same thing with the diner. When the doors open to that, you could see directly into the console room. But obviously they had to negotiate the fact that the external and the internal didn't match, and it didn't harm the story. And like I say, I think I understand why it was initially done. I can understand exactly for the same reason it was initially done in the Cushing films as well. If, you know, for fresh audiences, it gives you a very deliberate, concise connection between external and internal. But I think you lose the idea, and it's supposed to be fair, it's an idea which has never been touched on really at all.
Yeah.
This idea of the chameleon, that, you know, the police box is fixed as a police box, it should be able to change. So because we've never really dealt with that in the new series, the police box has become totally synonymous with that interior space when it shouldn't. This space should be almost like a scientific section within a, you know, a machine which changes how it looks out on the outside. So this internal place should not reflect the outside. I know we've gone way off the time flight here. But it's because there's so many TARDIS scenes at the moment in the show. So if you're watching this, I'm sure you're reflecting as we are on the TARDIS-y aspects here. That's
But I do like one aspect here in Time Flight where a lot of the humans are being controlled and just doing this job under hypnosis and so on. But then some of them break out of it and they're helping to break others out of it. You know, it's not really like the doctor breaks them out or the companion breaks them out. I like that because it kind of shows that humans aren't just these stupid people that later on they're made out to be, you know, and the doctor is incredible and only those that he brings with him are intelligent. You know, I like the fact that it shows that can do stuff as a people.
This could almost be a story where you could almost imagine if the doctor hadn't got involved, that these people would have somehow made their way out in some sort of like B-movie narrative of, you know, the missing flight 714 from Heathrow, and they end up, you know, the captain and his crew find another load of people and they have to fight this evil time.
It would have been a 50s sci-fi movie.
Exactly. And, you know, they'd have done things like snuck into his TARDIS and broken bits. And, you know, I know it's a far-fetched thing, but I think what I'm trying to say is I agree with you that there is that sort of element where the plot of them feels almost like their own entire story of themselves that carries them, which isn't governed by what the Doctor's doing, who's doing his own thing in his own higher level element of the story, dealing with the, you know, the psychic and this whole rather convincing alien at the moment. I quite like that. I mean, okay, the suit's fairly obvious, but that's fine. But I like the way that the head design sort of actually works within the overlay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Breaks up the shape of the face. That's really quite cool. And again, back to this lovely texture on the wall there.
Yeah.
That's quite
nice. I like how it looks. I mean, that back wall back there, it looks like it's concrete rather than some kind of natural stone, you know. And that's not a bad thing because it's like clearly a made structure, not a natural one. And I think it looks neat because it looks legitimately like concrete to me. Great finish on it, you know. Whereas in here, this room looks less realistic, looks more like a set.
Yes, this is one of the weaker rooms.
Yes. I don't necessarily mind it so much, but it's incredible how all the other kind of textures and surfaces, including the alien planet surface, looked more true.
I think the sad thing is, I could imagine if you saw this on set, this probably actually looked a lot better. I imagine it's to do with the way things light and lose some of the depth to the textures. And then I'm obviously not a filmmaker of the 80s, but I could imagine some of these things looked a lot better on set than they do when they're lit, and vice versa sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, just like think of any movie that you like from that era. I mean, hell, look at Star Wars movies, you know, and then you can see what some of those sets look like or even the props look like.
Yeah, absolutely.
Off screen, you know, so a lot of this stuff is, it's two things. It's how they look on film alone, versus just seeing to the naked eye, and how you light them, how realistic things can look. Because we've seen a few Doctor Who episodes, even on video, where lighting goes a long way and just makes them look incredible.
Yeah,
And as a matter of
absolutely.
fact, I was talking about how I liked the lighting in the Alien Planet, which was clearly
Yeah,
studio
absolutely.
made,
Yeah,
but the
very
lighting
much.
here looks more like they're shooting in a studio again,
Yeah.
where they're both shot in a studio.
I mean, to be fair to this scene, the lighting's still not as harsh as it often is.
No.
Sometimes the top of someone's head, like Davison's, can be almost a lit with sheen, and it's not overlit here. But as you say, I think the problem is the color palette here is just not good for television, with the texture just being lost. You can see there's a lot of texture there, but it is just lost, and then the lighting on top, it just loses. It's a shame, because if this whole set had been darker, I think they would have looked far more effective.
Do you think that this set could be suffering simply because of the overlay that they're doing here?
Could be.
I mean, I know we had overlay with the bubbles before, but I wonder if there were certain necessities to make these characters show up in this scene. Because it does seem like whoever was lighting this episode, like even this scene right here, this is great. I love the lighting in this scene.
This is almost comedy with the Master versus the flight crew of Concorde. That's effective as well. Again, these effects are fairly good. They remind me a little of the creatures in a Star Trek, the original series episode called The Empath.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I was going to say I'm kind of more reminiscent, going back to, I guess, oh God, so I just had the name and I've lost it now. Axels.
Oh, Axos, yeah, there's a lot of that. Oh, we have the Davison end episode sting face. He does pull that face when he's hitting his final shot. The shocked horror, how am I going to get out of this face? But otherwise known as the I'm sorry to tell you, Peter, but we couldn't get Matthew out of the contract, and he's the next episode face. No, I'm sure.
But the good news is you won't have to act with him. We're going to fob him off on the ladies.
I still really like that trick. I don't. I think in a weird way, this being a very ensemble story, in the sense there's a lot of heroic character, protagonist characters in there that you can follow and live through. You don't really miss him. But I think the crew feels weaker without him. Just Nyssa and Tegan don't really hold it for me.
Yeah, well, I've said for a long time too that I really think when Adric came in season 18, I thought he was fine. And for some reason, when they got to Peter's era, and perhaps it was the actor himself which inspired the writers, I don't know, but it seemed like they started to write him a little bit more annoying. And some episodes he's okay, and some he's not. So,
Yeah,
no, I mean, like,
absolutely.
just like Wesley on Star Trek: The Next Generation, people are a little too harsh on the both of them. I think they work, and they have moments possibly where they don't work. But, you know.
Absolutely. Right, I'm just going to say it's just ended that episode, so we're going to take a very quick break. So, pause it if you're following with the DVD, and we'll be back in a second. And we're back after a small break again for the final episode. We will count you in from four. So if you're ready, 4, 3, 2, 1, and we go. And back to the titles we go. So I mean, we have to be honest. In that small break, that little pocket of time for us, which you have not have enjoyed. We were having a look at the Yardley Jones, the box from this story, the police box, and I have to say we were talking earlier about this little extra piece that's on one the Planet Earth box, and it does exist on some of the boxes. We've been ex I don't know how we're going to explain this. I don't know whether we're going to have to get Christian to put a link in the show notes to explain what we're talking about here. It's very, very, it's minutiae. But again, as I say, the fact that we're interested in these minutiae is fascinating in itself, that these tiny markers, because it becomes less about the show, it becomes more about the history of the show, doesn't it? You're looking at cause and effect in a weird way. It's something you love. You've got a continuity of a show you love from 1963 to hopefully 2016, maybe 2010, who knows. You know, and at that, and you're looking and you're plotting the history of that life of that show and its elements by those, you know, visible icons, I guess. And the police box is constant, and it's a fascination, and then just seeing how it changes. And it's I know we've had to justify this many, many, many times, probably far too many times over, but what I think is fascinating, as me and Brian were saying, is it's just amazing, is it no matter how many times you've seen these shows, you often find these small little minutiae things which are fascinating. And I guess that is what's fascinating, is that you know, why looking for these small things is interesting, because it gives you an extra thing to look for, isn't it?
Yeah, well, in many ways, for me, it's not only that, like, you have this extra thing that you look for, it's that as many times as we watch these things, aside from the fact that we can look for them, and sometimes, you know, you and I will probably purposely go through an episode looking specifically at this TARDIS, you know what I mean? Mm. But what it gives you is the realization that as many times as we've seen these episodes, there is always something new still to catch. There's always something in there to enjoy. I mean, we're talking about the sets here in Time Flight and the alien planet, the Khalid's room or the master's room, you know, the chamber of the alien race, you know. So many great visuals going on. And then one of the things that's just really taking us is this tiny little aspect of the police box from this era that I don't think either one of us had noticed before.
No, absolutely.
You know? And to find out, what are we finding out now? That it's on some of the versions of this box, or some of the sides of this box? Like, what do you think? Is it on two sides of this box, or were you in the camp that there were the two boxes?
Well, interestingly enough, I think, there were two boxes. There was a Mark One and Mark Two. One was a fiberglass, one wasn't. But I think what they did, there was a lot of interchanging of pieces of them. And some people have said of how the Mark One police public call box sign gets worn away and swapped over. And interestingly enough, I'm just on a website at the moment, and it's the same website you were on, Brian, we were looking through. And if you want to go to page 8, and they are actually talking about what they're calling the strange case of the appearing and disappearing styles, which is this section that we're talking about, which is just above the police box sign. And there's a little bit, it almost looks like the central partition of the doorway has gone through the police box sign and come out the top. But it's actually something which is actually set as part of that, of the police box section, which, looking at some of the bits on here, they've got some bits of the original props on display, they've got photos of. It looks like it's part of the actual police box sign section, which would explain how it appears and disappears depending on whether they're using.
Okay. I was having it. There we go. Now I'm there with page 8.
If you go further down, it's quite funny. And we're on a website called TARDISbuilders.com, which we've mentioned before. It is an absolutely fascinating website. If you get beyond the issue that some people have of people over-focusing on stuff, get past that and look and see these people really talking and learning. And the community is fascinating, watching them chats about all this stuff and reading it. I've never got involved in this. I've always lurked, and I just find it brilliant. I love how resourceful they are, and they find where all these bits, these props come from, or they remake them or find bits. It's brilliant.
We'll have to supply the link to this particular thread.
Yes,
for the show notes for sure. I'll tell you what, though, looking at this one photo. And I know we're both obsessing over police boxes here, but hey, you know, it's fine. It's in the story, right? Right?
Absolutely.
Not sure that one, the Bonham shot,
yeah,
showing the actual sign box with that part on it. But if you go back to page 6, the very last shot, somebody proposes an interesting theory there. I don't know if it's true, but it could stand a reason why we would see it and not see it. It would, because we know that the signs are removable, not just the sign boxes, but the signs are removable. But somebody's proposing that it was meant to be slotted into the steps.
Oh.
And sometimes it's put together where they didn't realize that, and they put it together with all the, because it looks, if you don't know it's meant to be slotted in the steps, it looks like it's a continuation of the door jamb frame. It's an interesting theory. Who knows if it's true? Because whoever has seen these real ones will know the actual truth. And I have to admit, since we're watching the episode and only looking at pictures, I'm not reading all of the accompanying notes that people are writing here. But I think that's a really kind of interesting theory somebody has there, you know?
But this is the nature of history, isn't it? It's the sort of dissemination of what you presume to what actually is, or trying to get close as enough as you can to what actually was. And because we make so many assumptions, and these things, while they are tiny and small, to some carpenter or some fiberglass molder, you know, these sort of things were things that they were dealing with, you know, and you're trying to get into the sort of mindset of what was going on there. It's a really weird historical nuance, which I just love the fact that they're there. And I think it's just so scary when you think how long ago this was. But yeah, I totally agree. Yeah, I'm looking at page 6 now, which is interesting.
Yeah, they continue that over on page 7. I have to admit, I'm getting so distracted from part 4 of this story right now with this little bit. So hopefully everybody can follow along on this link, because it's really worth it. My God, is that the inside of the real fiberglass box on page 7? Is that a real one?
You're all going to be. There should be a commentary on the show. It should be a commentary on TARDIS Builders.
Yeah, we're going to have to. choose the name of this podcast carefully, I think.
Have to choose it very carefully indeed. But okay, here's a question: Is this episode too long? Should it have been 3 parts? Does it feel to you that people might have got distracted, or do you think the parts work if we think about it within context to its broadcasting, where it was just 20-minute parts a week? Were those 20-minute parts interesting enough in themselves, do you think?
Do you know, it's really tough, because there are plenty of 4-part stories in this show that I sit there and I think are completely worth it. I used to think 4 parts was the perfect amount of parts, you know, rather than 6, even though something like Genesis totally works on 6 parts, you know. But when you think about it, when you think about writing a movie, for instance, and you look at the length of a typical Doctor Who episode from this era, you're essentially writing a movie, you know, and you've got the beginning, the middle, and the end is generally the breakdown of a movie. It really does make sense, like we were talking on one of the McCoy podcasts, that 3 parts is just ideal. 3 parts would be perfect, because you're not padding, you're not stretching, you're not throwing too much information. And occasionally you probably could get a pretty great 4-part story, because you've got enough story to spread out evenly. In the case of this one, I don't know. It in some ways it does feel like we're running back and forth between Khalid's place and the hidden cave and so on, and the dilemmas otherwise. But I kind of like, it's not as simple as we brought the TARDIS, let's get out of here with the TARDIS now, it's all done. You know, you got to make the trade-off with the Master, that's going to happen, and I like this stuff. I don't know. Would this one be better as a 3-parter? Is really tough, because admittedly we got sidetracked with the TARDIS, yes, but take that aside. When we do these commentary tracks, sometimes it's a little hard to pay attention to what's best for the story. And sometimes it's very easy to say. It depends on how far we get distracted in the commentary. This particular story I enjoy. I don't think I have a problem with it being 4. Maybe I'm rambling now, but I don't.
No, I think it's a fair point. I mean, if we always say these commentaries, the way we try and do them is we try and keep it a little distant from the story. So if you're not watching it, you've got something other than people going, oh, I like this bit. This all looks cool. I know we've done it a couple of times, but we try and limit it so it can be watched as a complement to the story. And so we will go off base. And it's great. I mean, I love it when he goes on long talks like that, because I've just been reading up. I've just been, because they're now saying that Planet of Fire is the first time that the spires actually appear on the side panels, not just the front. So again,
oh, get out.
That's
so do you think it is that flipped sign? Do you think that's what it is?
It could be. It's hard.
It's a very plausible theory.
Fascinating, absolutely fascinating. But okay, it's not. Sorry, it's probably not. But I don't know. I seem to think it is. Yeah, no, it's. I don't think this is a bad story at all. I must admit, I've not seen it in a while, and I was surprised as we've been rewatching this how good the exterior, when I say exterior, the outside locations shot inside are. That backdrop, the layering to the backdrop, to before, as you say, you get to the sky, it's really nice. You really feel a distance there.
Well, and I'll tell you what, I've been watching a lot of Star Trek The Next Generation lately. And in some of the earlier seasons, and as a matter of fact, I even just got to one in season 7, they went down to an alien planet, which was clearly a set with a backdrop sky. And that's crazy. I've never thought of that. Wow, that's amazing. This is what, 81? And Star Trek The Next Generation started in 87. I was going to say that they were in completely different leagues, and here we're still using alien like sets as alien planets, you know. Yeah. But they're in the same realm. That's incredible. I didn't even they seem so vastly different. I guess it's the budgets, but
I remember
the technology. Go on.
I remember in 1987, 88 when I saw Encounter at Farpoint and season 1 of Next Generation that I was unimpressed with the sets on the planet sets. So maybe by that point, Next Generation was doing what was dated. So as you say, they are close to each other, but I kind of felt by that point that you were expecting something more, while at this point you're expecting something, you're expecting this and then pleased with what you get, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. Well, no, but at the same time, though, like season 7 of Next Generation, and that went on, or maybe it was 6 that I was in, but I swear it was 7. Could have been 6. Let's just say it was season 6, the second to last season. It was a really good alien-looking planet, you know, and it worked. You know, I mean, sure, you know, going to see, say, Star Trek Beyond, seeing their alien planets, like, forget it. You're never going to compete with that big budget in CGI, and they do it well in that film. But here it still worked in Next Generation, and here it's working on this planet, this show, and it's budgetary restraints, it's TV. I mean, like, if you had given Doctor Who in that time the budget that a TV show would have now,
yeah,
I'm sure they would do something greater. But with the budget that they had, and that's one of the main things that I think we've hinted on before, is how far this TV show could stretch a budget and oftentimes pull something amazing off. For the era, of course, rather than utterly fail. And some of them fail. You know, some of them aren't so great. They didn't spend the money so wisely, or they didn't have money to spend wisely, you know. But I think they did well in this story. And I'm impressed with that. I'm impressed with the story. I like the characters. Like I said in the last episode, I like that the humans are basically figuring certain things out for their own, even if they have some push with the doctor helping them. I like that. It's one of the first times I can think of that humans aren't just like solely sitting there being bumbling idiots with the doctor directing them all along, unless it's UNIT, you know, and even they became a joke later on, you know. Mm.
Do you think there was resistance to a certain, you could almost say a lack of location, in the sense that you have this barren world, and then you have a few sort of cavern areas, but that's really it for you know, 2.5 parts. You don't really get much more than that. Do you think some people felt that was a little limiting? Because it's okay to, and we've argued this with Timon and Arnie, and when we do the commentary, I'm sure this will come up. Is that whole thing of I thought we'd done Time, but we haven't. We've actually talked. We've watched Time of the Rani separately, didn't we? And then we came and talked about it. I think that's why. Yeah, but with Time of the Rani, it's the same problem. Is you have these locations, but they feel a bit sort of desperate. They don't really connect particularly well. I mean, with Time Flight, they're either in the building or they're far away from the building, standing by the Concorde. You know, there's no real sense of particularly strong sense of geography there to make you feel. Maybe that's something that people had issues.
You know, that's probably a strong argument for a 3-part story. Because we did talk about this before, where and I forget which classic story it was now, but whatever one we had done fairly recently that had it might have been it was Dalton and Bannerman, I think, where we were talking about like all the diverse sets and areas they went to, because it was an outside location and on-set locations that were just great, whereas a new series episode would even bounce between like two sets, you know, three sets or something. So maybe that is one of the bummer things about this, is that, you know, we just have these what do we have, three cave locations and then the exterior of this planet. And really, I mean, that should be enough, but I guess because they are what they are and they're a limited view, a limited field of vision on these sets, it probably is limiting this story a little bit. I mean, we never even truly get to see the inside of the Master's TARDIS.
No. I mean, it's in a sense, is that sort of a problem, or is it a curse or a blessing when you've got only 20-minute episodes, so you're only getting it in short bursts, but it means that those, as you say, those 3 to 4 locations span you a month of Doctor Who. That's quite a long time to be spatting forthing between. So I'm wondering whether that would cause a gradual frustration, or whether because you're not seeing it all in one go, it wouldn't seem quite so heavy that you're just stuck within. Because I tend to find that with Doctor Who, when you watch them as 90-minute shows, is that you get a far more of a sort of frustration of feeling that lack of locations that any show or any story tends to have, where you do only have certain set places that you're going back and forth between, which is perhaps less evident when it's 20 minutes. I'm not sure. It's a difficult one.
Well, no, you make a good argument when you think about it. You watch a TV show nowadays, even the new series of Doctor Who, one story is over in one night. Occasionally, it's over in two nights, but over the course of 2 weeks. Whereas here, 4 weeks, if you're not varying the sets, it's still one continual story, and that's fine. It's serialized. But for 4 weeks, you're showing everybody the same thing. And it's a little bit different here. Going back to trying to think of another four-part episode we did recently. Well, let's even take, like look at City of Death, for instance. You know, there were many locations in there, and sure, they were in France and so on, and they were in sets and whatnot, but that one, for some reason, strikes out to me, and I know a lot of people think it's, like, the best story since ever, but, you know, I think location-wise, it stands out to me as something that works well. Even though they're reusing a lot of sets, they're not dwelling on sets as this one has done for 3 weeks now.
But then it does do, as I recall, what this one has done as well. And you have this nice diversity in sort of parts one and parts four. But parts two and three, you end up sort of sitting around the same. Because I tend to, well, no, that's not true, I suppose, because City of Death, you do go back to Leonardo da Vinci's, don't you, in part three. Is that at the end of part three, the biting of the for the thumb screws?
I believe so.
It's at the back end. So, but that sort of middle ground is pretty much going backwards and forth between Scaglione's lab and outs and the cafe. You know, it's all a bit, and that tends to happen in Doctor. I know we're just talking about that one specific one where you sort of have, the setup has a bit of variance. The ending naturally needs a bit of variance. But then the middle two episodes are the difficult ones. I imagine they're the difficult ones. Well, middle acts are difficult, aren't they? Because you've got nothing to set up. You've got nothing to resolve. You've just got a perpetuation between beginning and end to sort out. And I think Doctor Who can sometimes struggle there. Maybe Time Flight has struggled a little bit in certainly part three, maybe. I don't know.
You know, it's a shame, though. You make a good point with City of Death, that they took us to Leonardo's. They gave us a break from the other sets that we've been seeing for the past 2 weeks. You know, in that third week, they give us something new. And maybe that's what this story needed to do. And it's kind of sad to think that, you know, just a change of location, which is very costly for them to do, would have been something helpful to help give the story a different pace. Or to feel fresher again. So maybe if they had even gone in the Concorde for a little while, or gone back to Heathrow somehow, or part of them went back to Heathrow somehow, something could have freshened it up. And maybe that's what you have to do with a four-parter. Maybe if you have enough story for a four-parter, but you don't have enough areas to make it look vastly different. Because even think about a movie, if we're going back to the movie analogies, they're not going to dwell on the same areas for too long in a film. They're going to carry you around. They're going to move the story along. You know, very few things do that. You know, you're going to get very few movies like Cube, for example, that are going to work with having one set throughout the entire film. You know, and you got to be real clever with your story in order to do that, to make it not seem boring. So maybe that's what's going on here, because personally, I think the story works. I like that they went back in time the way that they did, and I like how it all started. But you're right, it can feel
it depends.
Like we're stuck.
I think in the end, it depends also how much you engage, the rest engages. I do like what you said earlier, and I think it's very true, that the fact that there is this other level of what the crew are doing, which is largely disassociated from what the Doctor's doing. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, often the other characters are doing something, but it's often they're sort of sitting underneath his team, and but here they sort of are pretty much working under their own impetus. That does sort of keep episode three moving for me. And obviously, yeah. Amy's amusing. But I think you're right. It's a problem. And I think it's the same with all Doctor Who. That led, and the best ones tend to have something different for the last act. I mean, I was thinking of Talons of Wing Chiang, which is six episodes, but the last two episodes are radically different to the previous four. So it shifts away from where it's been going backwards and forth from the theatre and moves to the Wing Chiang, to the lair mm-hmm. at the end. And that was really needed. And I think ones that fail to do that tend to be the ones which don't. If they don't have, as you say, that part four, which does something different, and I'm thinking of Power of Krol springs to mind. Stones of Blood is perhaps re-energized by having the last section, last third, on the spaceship, in the warp hyperspace. So I think you're right, and this unfortunately doesn't get back to Heathrow quick enough, where I think
yeah.
it would have been interesting.
Probably would have been a good way to do the end of episode three, get them back to Heathrow and maybe show the Master wreaking havoc there, you know?
Because there's a lot of dull exposition in episode three. I mean, you have this, I mean, they look quite good, but you know, when you've got the, where you've got the Zerafin and you've got the TARDIS team for about 6-7 minutes, Tegan, the Doctor and Nyssa just have to stand there. There's nothing else to do. And they're just literally yeah. standing there. You think, my God, how long are they going to have to just stand there? So I think there needed to be some sort of truncations, as you say, and either move this to a three-parter or... Because, I mean, you could have done with part four what actually they do in the next episode in Arc of Infinity, where you have the fourth part is really actually a fairly dull chase, but it is a chase around Amsterdam. But it's very different from the whole Gallifrey thing that's been going on previous. So it re-energizes a fairly average story by having this interesting novel thing of the Doctor running through Amsterdam chasing Peter Davison. That works. So maybe this is what Time Flight needed, was a sort of chase, the Master chase through Heathrow.
I would have been all over that, because I think, you know, and I guess obviously you have limited time there, but, you know, you could, how hard would it be to find a location that you could just have double as some hallways in Heathrow? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It would have been so difficult to get that going on. I think that would have helped it.
Is this episode just an example of one of the lower budget episodes of the season, which they've just done quite well, or is it a one that costs more? I mean, I've not really read up on Time Flight, so I'm not saying it's either way, but it could be one or the other. I mean, I suppose it has got quite a heavy amount of exterior location for part one, which is always costly to do and sort out, and time, as you say, and then you outside is always a pain, as you know. But at the same time, some of the sets are fairly good in it, aren't they? But they are very staple, and there isn't really any particular monsters per se. There's a few people in costume, including Amy. It feels in some ways quite cheap, and yet sometimes it feels quite as if it's trying to push the boundaries a bit and just not quite managed. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't... It's really tough. I mean... As many times as I've watched this before, it's interesting, you know, to watch it with you and to think about these other aspects. I can't say they bothered me before, but then again, who knows how I felt the first or second time I may have watched it. You know, I'm so used to it by now. And a lot of times when watching this show anymore, I'm doing other things, like it's on while I'm working. It's companionship to whatever I'm doing, you know. But yeah, it's very tough because It could have been one of those budgeted episodes where they're like, look, we just spent money to make four gigantic sets that we have to use, and we've paid money to get some shots done with a Concorde. Like, you know, it probably ran out of any kind of extra resources because of that. But
I think perhaps the biggest problem with this episode is the only thing I remember from it as being a kid is Tegan regretting her decision running back and the Doctor's gone. That's the only thing I remember from actually my first time watching it. The only thing which, so in a sense, if I don't remember any of it, it just shows it didn't really have an impact on me apart from that scene. And I thought I remembered there being a longer gap between her returning rather than it being the next episode, which always made it feel a bit bizarre that they did it like that. But
that always bugged me that they did that. But no, you make a good point though, because I remember a little bit more of the story. Like I always remember the beginning when they land in Heathrow and wander around Heathrow. Like, to me, for whatever reason, Heathrow made a big impact. And then the only other big thing that I really remember the story, and you'd think you would remember Ainley in that disguise, because it's really one of his best disguises. But instead, I remember the swap of the TARDIS parts between he and the Doctor. You know, so it's like Tegan leaving, the Heathrow stuff, and the Doctor and the Master like swapping TARDIS bits as part of a deal. I don't know why, but they're the things I recall the most with this story. So maybe you're right. Maybe I came into this as a proponent for the story. I enjoy it. And for whatever reason, I do enjoy it. But maybe it's not that great. Maybe it is just made up of little moments that I enjoy. Who knows?
Is that a bad thing, though, if there's those moments are ones to be enjoyed?
Yeah, I mean, hey, it keeps me putting the story back on, you know. So keeps me coming back for more.
So out of the season, do you think it's, how would you rate it? Or could you rank it in this season? Is it, it's an odd season, this.
Yeah, and I'm going to totally completely cheat right here because I forget what's in the rest of the season offhand.
Well, I was just... because we've got we obviously got Castrovalva, Force Doomsday, and then do we move to Black? Is it Visitation then Black Orchid? Or is it Black Orchid
Kinder,
then?
Kinder the Visitation.
Kinder Black Orchid. Visitation Black Orchid, Earthshock, and Time Flight.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting scene. I mean, I've always loved Black Orchid. So
yeah.
That's always been one of my favourite. I think Kinder's got some very strong moments in it. If it is a bit overlong.
And I'm one of, I don't know how others feel, but I'm one of those ones. I enjoy Castrovalva.
I love Castrovalva.
Yeah, and I think it's like the M.C. Escher aspect of this place or something. I don't know, but I like the story. I like how it unfolds.
Well, again, I like the variety. You have the first part, which is all TARDIS based. So you know, it's almost like a 1+3-parter. Almost like this is a 1+3-parter. I kind of like that sort of setup. So yeah, Fall to Doomsday. I like the aesthetic. I remember being quite. I remember it very vividly as a child, so it made an impact on me. But it is a very messy story in itself. Yeah. In Adric's characters all over the place, there's a lot of problems with it. Visitation is very enjoyable. Earthshock is obviously very good. So I think it's a pretty strong season. This. It's,
maybe Time Flight takes a lot of flack because that's the last one from this season, right?
Yes.
The next season, Tegan's back with Ark of Infinity. Yeah. Maybe it takes a lot of flack because it wasn't necessarily a strong ending to a season. And granted, I mean, this is in an era where, like, we don't really get, you know, Russell T. Davis or Moffat series enders, you know, like, or even Star Trek or other TV shows of the like, you know, you don't. It wasn't made up like that.
No.
So, but even then, maybe back then, it was just kind of like, this is what we're left with till next year or whenever it comes back. Maybe that's why.
I suppose in the end it has to compete with Fall to Doomsday as a sort of flawed but not unwatchable bit of television. The others, I think, are better, I can think of that season. So maybe that's the other problem.
Yeah, and think about it. Fall to Doomsday has what? It's just got that spaceship as a set for absolutely. All four episodes.
Yeah. But you know, start to feel
this,
it.
This one seems to offer more. Yeah. And I don't know. I think Time Flight works better, personally.
Yeah, I think it does as well. I mean, I think I like... there's a couple of things in Fall to Doomsday which I think are very powerful. I think having the personification of enlightenment it's really interesting, you know, taking it from the creatures to the well-suited Teagan drawings. I thought it was a very nice idea. I thought I can't remember the actor's name, suddenly escaped me. The lead villain, very famous Zed Cars. Anyway, that's the beauty of podcast, isn't it? You know, there's a lot of good elements to it, and then there's a lot of rubbish in it. There's a lot of, you know, almost Morris dancing for extended periods. Adric has nothing to do, and what he does is utterly nonsensical. Teagan is a mess. The story doesn't really have a good ending. Yeah, no, I think you're right. This is a far better, far more fun trip. If you put these out as sort of 90-minute VHS omnibus stories at £9.99 or $10 or wherever you come from, and you bought them, I think this would be a far more satisfying watch.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, especially as a kid. There's, you know, as you say, there's a certain amount of adventure to it. You know, you start off in Heathrow, you end up in Alien Planet, and then you're ending up with telepathic hypnosis, time traveling Concords. It's bizarre, and it's a bit out there.
You know, and going back real quick to what we were talking about earlier with continuity, and how we were saying like even since the earliest days of Doctor Who, they really kind of trampled on their own continuity quite a bit. But you just made something stand out to me, which was in For to Doomsday, Teagan does those drawings of fashion. Enlightenment and who's the other one? It's Enlightenment. I've forgotten the other name already.
Perseverance or something.
Yes.
Anyway,
yeah. Sure. Yeah, we'll go with that.
We know about police boxes, but
there you go. No, but you know, they turn those drawings that Teagan made into a reality, and then you get all the way to the Five Doctors, and they're on the Eye of Orion, and who's the artist there? It's Turlough. It's like, did you forget that Teagan was an artist? Like, you could have just made her have that job.
Though I quite like Davison's sort of slight reproach to how good it is.
Oh, yeah.
It's obviously rubbish. Or at least he thinks he's rubbish, and he's not really got many qualms about sort of making that clear. Absolutely.
I'll tell you what, I mean, there's if you guys get to the end of that thread that we've linked to about the TARDISes on the TARDIS builders, there is a link to another thread on the same box. And it's one of my favorite things that fans do. I mean, like, many of you know that I'm a sonic screwdriver or even Doctor Who prop collector. And in fact, I'm adding two new sonic screwdrivers to my collection soon, which you could argue are kind of niche kind of sonic screwdrivers to pick up, you know, kind of real rarities that people might not even ever consider or even realize were in the show. But the depths that we will go to get screen accuracy, I'm looking on this one thread and they're circling like dings and nicks in the window frames, you know?
Isn't it brilliant?
Yeah. Oh, it's fantastic. It really is. I love it. I love how far people will go. And that's the beautiful thing, too, with doing replica police boxes. There's only two ways you go with a replica police box. Three, I guess you could argue if you want to be that pedantic about it. But you've got screen accurate, which you're just going to make a Yardley Jones box. You're going to make a Yardley Jones box, you know. And I guess this is where I'm saying the three. You can say this is one and 1.5 way if you want. You're going to make the Yardley Jones box, or you're going to make it with the exact dings, nicks, paint chips, oddities of the top post sign pips or whatever
spires.
You want to call them. Yeah, you know. Or what a lot of fans do is they'll say, I love this aspect of the season 18. I love this aspect of the McGann TARDIS box. I'm going to go ahead and put the St. John's badge from Matt Smith's specific box. Or the lantern from the Smith box, you know, and you make an amalgamation. Because you think about it, one of my favorite fan theories of all time for this show is that the TARDIS chameleon circuit isn't broken in the respect that it is completely non-functional and therefore stuck in the shape of a police box. It's operating. And every time it lands somewhere, or maybe not every time, but like every once in a while, it goes, oh, right, I'm supposed to blend in with my surroundings. And it tries to change again. And all it does is effectively make itself into a slightly different looking police box. And I used to think that was such a great theory. And I still think it even holds true. I mean, when you think about it, when the TARDIS regenerated itself in Series 5, it still just became another looking police box. So, you know, sure, maybe it's sitting there thinking this is what the Doctor knows, as I guess Moffat wants us to think. I just like to think the police box is like, look, I tried. I was trying to be a boulder. I thought it would fit in here on this, you know, this quarry that we've landed in, but I can't. I've just managed to put some spires on top of the sign boxes and, you know, and I've changed some wording on the door sign. I'm so sorry. You know, I think that's great. I just think it's hilarious. And it's a great way to explain why the box looks so different all the time when it's supposed to be the same old box, you know? It's a beautiful little aspect.
Absolutely. And as I think we've said before, even down to the, to the books sort of covered this as well, even down to, as I say, the New Adventures covered it, where I think even Mark Gatiss's books would note the slight differences. The TARDIS had changed its look and it now had the Syntambulan sign on the front and things like that. So it is almost sort of as canonical as these things can be canonical. My God, it's another 13-page thread on this box. It's incredible.
I know.
And they are just some of the most amazing, some lovely promo shots as well in here. There's a great one on the last page of Nicola Brandt with two policemen and Colin, which probably sounds like some Doctor Who fan's most exciting dream, but she's standing on a wireless to match them. Just shows how short she is.
It's funny because, like, I can tell you differences in the sonic screwdrivers, like it's my job, I guess. You know, I've researched the heck out of those because I collect every one. When it comes down to the police boxes, it's kind of a weird thing. Like, once you settle on the box that you're going to replicate, well, then you go into the ins and outs of that box entirely. Like this 13-page thread about this, the Yardley, this particular box, the Yardley Jones box. It's just what you do. I mean, like, now some people will obsess over all the boxes completely, but me in particular, I know the box that I replicated, which was the Series 4 Tennant box, you know, and so I didn't notice these little differences in the classic boxes, and I'm still picking up aspects of them, because while I know the differences basically by looking at a box, which one it may be, I don't know all the ins and outs of what's different between that box from when it first entered the show to when it last left the show. So it's very interesting. It's a great way to enjoy this show many times over by dealing into the different facets of it outside of what you see on the screen, or many times what you are seeing on the screen but not realizing it's different per episode, per story, per year. So it is fascinating that I can still, like, tune into to areas like this and just say, like, you know, it's amazing. Those spires, never saw them. You know, you told me that was on that replica box, and I'm just like, oh, they messed up. I'm thinking to myself, they messed up. No way, that's there. They're there. It's incredible.
I know. And if you go to page 13 on the second thread, there's a great graphic which explains very succinctly the differences in the box, this particular box, through the different eras, with underlined, bolded letters to make sure you're very clear that the spires were not present on this version in season 19.
Oh my God, hold on now. I'm going to get to that graphic, but first I'm looking at the top picture on page 13.
That's the one.
That's the one, the top picture? Oh my God, it's the police box. It's Colin, Nicola, and two police officers standing in front of this police box, but the sign box up top, it doesn't even have the letters. It doesn't say police public call box, and the sign is taped. Yeah. Like, did they even use blue tape, or did they go, don't worry, we're shooting in black and white, just put some black tape on the thing?
No,
like,
idea.
What is it? That's terrible. And I know it's just promo. And
don't bother about terrible. The lamp. Don't need the lamp.
Yeah. Right. And it's incredible, too, because, like, when was this promo shot? Like, Nicola's wearing, like, what was that season? Colin's first season. She's got her first season outfit on, but her hair doesn't look at all like it was in that first season. It looks very good. Matter of fact, I don't even think it ever looked like that in the show.
I was wondering whether it was to promote sort of Attack of the Cybermen or something, you know, with the policeman. But no, I think it's just a promo. It might even been pre-season. Who knows? But it's yes, it's a very dishevelled box. I found that funny because I thought you were going to mention Nicola Brown, but no, you're actually going to mention the box behind her, which is
well, I mean, come on. First of all, like, the one thing I was going to say was she's one of those people who just remains gorgeous to this day. You know, she's not aging. It's just weird. She just always looks amazing. But her hair looks so utterly different here, but it looks so good. It looks so cute. But I couldn't help it. We were looking at the box and like two things stood out to me. One is that box is taped on and the other one appears to have no side. Like, what is that that we're looking at on the left sign box there? I'm sure people are completely and utterly fascinated
I
by
know,
our police box
what
talk
the hell
right
are
now.
Are they talking about? But then, if you look by seasons 20 to 21, they'll tell you all these sort of various things. Is the one of the signs? It certainly says in season 18 that one of the police box signs was actually no, it didn't exist, was missing, the real one. I don't know. It's great. It's fascinating. And this is a lot of this work is by a guy called Tony Farrell, who's in a lot of these threads. I think he did one on the original box as well. So, again, we apologize because we've spoken through pretty much all of episode 4 on this.
Yeah, and, well, you know, and before we get to the end of the podcast, I do want to say, though, you and I are fascinated by this stuff. And you know, I've talked before about sonic screwdrivers and so on. But if you out there listening, you know, if, you know, the podcast regular or the commentary podcast, whichever you like, if there's a story you want to hear us do a commentary on, if there's a podcast you want us to talk about, like if you want to hear more about police boxes in depth, you know, we'll pull up some police boxes to talk about or props or whatever. Shoot us a message on our Twitter, on our Facebook page. Leave us a message on the podcast page where you're listening. Let us know because I would, first of all, if you're enjoying us, hearing us talk about police boxes, great. That's fantastic. I'd love to know that because we'll talk about it some more. We'll talk about other aspects you like. We love it.
Of course
clearly,
you are you now. Know? You're opening the field for people to come and say, no, we do not want you talking about police boxes
well,
for an
you
entire
know,
episode and you should be talking about Time Flight.
It, well, yeah, in fairness, we probably shouldn't have tangented so much on Time Flight, but let's say not during a commentary track. How's that?
Yes, maybe so.
Yeah.
Maybe so.
Sorry, we did tangent there. Apologies, but hey, you know, there's a real commentary for Time Flight. We'll just say it that way.
Absolutely, yeah. So as we always say, you know, if you want something that's specific to the show, you know, the commentaries on the DVD boxes are really very good frequently, especially the fifth era, which tend to have some very good lineups. So do go and grab one of those to listen to and enjoy something which isn't so police box heavy. But yeah, even if you're not into police boxes, go and have a look at that site, because if you're not into it, you'll just be amused by the sheer detail and you'll probably snort and close the window with an amused smile. Others might just actually find it genuinely fascinating to see people dialogue on this. And then others like us will have probably read it already, so
yeah, well, and I'll tell you, like, so I'm sure some of these people listening are already like, yeah, I know all these details. I've got one in my house, et cetera, you know, or they're a model collector or whatever. But I'll bet you one of the things – oh, that's an interesting shot there too, tangenting myself. One of the interesting things about me is that a lot of times I would be watching an aspect of the show or just looking at a thread on, say, the Sonic Screwdriver, and somebody will tangent on something else there, and I'll click their link, and it'll bring me to a page about police boxes or something, and then I find myself scrolling through 20 pages of a thread just because I find it now fascinating.
Absolutely.
So who knows? You never know. You might tune in here and like, you might be annoyed we tangented about police boxes, but then you may come in here and you go, well, crap, those two, I see what they mean. This is rather fascinating. Or you might come in here and laugh at us. Hey, knock yourself out.
Absolutely. So, so any final comments on Time Flight?
I still enjoy it, and I'm sticking to my story on that. I'm impressed by a lot of the production value on the sets. Like we talked about that one set, the chamber set, I was surprised, and I'm just going to assume it came down to CSO work on that, because I can't imagine somebody was doing so well with lighting and set design on that story that one utterly failed. Aside from that, I'm impressed with the look of it. I like the story. And I can't say it's the weakest link of that season by any means.
Good. So, are we done? I accidentally closed mine.
Yeah, well, I think we're done. Yeah.
Good. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this ramble into Time Flight, into Peter Davison. I enjoyed it. Hopefully you'll come back and listen to either us doing another one or maybe some interesting Doctor Who news if it ever happens. Something interesting might happen that's worth talking about, apart from Capaldi maybe staying on after according to Moffat, who has got a long history of being someone who doesn't lie to the press. So, I'm sorry, guys, if you do think that he's coming back after season 10, I still don't think he is. I think, as one journalist friend of mine said, Chibnall would be absolutely mad. You know, if you're trying to reboot your show, revitalize it, bring back a lead actor, you know, I don't know. I'd be very surprised. If he is, that's cool.
Hey, I don't know how you can say that. Series 6, Stephen Moffat said the Doctor was dead. It's a real death. It's an actual death. He died. You know, I mean, come on. The man doesn't lie to us.
Absolutely.
Anyway, so that's the end of this podcast. It is
actually. It is actually the end. So I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll catch you for another podfast.